Marshall and Sagar here. Welcome back to The Realignment. The Realignment is a podcast that explores the dramatic political realignment facing the United States.
Conventional wisdom has been upended, especially with the unexpected election of President Trump, populist revolts across Europe, and the arrival of an aggressive and unapologetic China. We're living in a time of new challenges to the way America and our leaders approach policy.
All this is playing out while the social fabric of our country frays and our politics continue to further divide us.
This podcast is focused on cutting through the noise and unpacking the issues at the heart of this realignment with politicians, thought leaders, journalists, and more. This week, we sat down with Klon Kitchen. He leads the tech policy team over at the Heritage Foundation.
I think tech is the policy area where the ideas that we focus on this podcast best intersect. Because you have, and you hear this in our conversation, national security, we're talking about Huawei and China and TikTok. We're talking about economics. We're talking about whether, when we're looking at these companies have so much power, whether we can compare them to previous forms of business that really dominated in the 20th century. And then finally, you just have science, right? You have the debate about whether or not these companies are making innovations that benefit everybody.
Yeah, no other sector really highlights all the things that we talk about here at The Realignment. And this episode in particular, we focus on this debate. It's about big tech regulation, free speech online, bias, privacy. Should the government get involved? What role do we have? The legal frameworks that govern all of these questions.
And Klon was the perfect person to sit down to have this conversation with. He's worked on the Hill. He's obviously deeply focused on policy. And I think most importantly, he has a deep empathy that he brings to this conversation that I think will help people approach it regardless of how they see these big questions. Let's dive in. Klon, welcome to The Realignment.
It's my pleasure. Happy to be here.
Yeah, thanks for being here.
So one of the issues that I think best exemplifies what we talk about this show, aka the way that our politics is changing, is tech policy and its intersection with national security. And you do work in both fields, so you're the perfect one to talk to with us. Let's just start off. What are your thoughts on the way the realignment idea sort of intersects with the post-2016 state of our politics in your work area?
Yeah, so to the degree, that's a great question. You guys are tracing out the contours of this interesting political realignment that's going on. A portion of that realignment is being reflected in the growing geopolitical influence of technology companies. Mm-hmm. So, for example, these companies have truly global interests, mm-hmm. right? They operate in every major market. They are building and supplying themselves with human capital from every country, every major country. In 2018, they have interests that are becoming on par with countries. So, you know, for example, in 2018, you know, Apple had over $265 billion in revenue. That's not net worth, just revenue.
Right.
Amazon had $330 billion and so on and so forth. And the point is, you take the top five U.S. tech companies and their annual profit constitutes something on par with the GDP of Saudi Arabia.
Wow.
In 2018. Five companies. Yeah. Right? So these companies have global interests and they're increasingly operating as global actors. So that's part of it. But then, too, one of the things that I'm spending a lot of time working on is what I call the migration of national security capabilities into the private sector. So the things that are going to be shaping and winning future geopolitical conflicts, things like artificial intelligence, robotics, synthetic materials, and the like, well, the overwhelming energy in the development of those capabilities is in the private sector. And the government just isn't going to out-Google Google. And so this is the context for a lot of the way I think about and engage these other issues that you guys are spending such a good amount of time kind of tracing out.
Hmm. And the thing I'd add to that, too, is that what's new about the sort of tech, national security, global playing field is that you now have Chinese companies that are actually coming into our markets. So TikTok, mm-hmm. incredibly successful, very popular amongst younger Americans, is a foreign company. And that's not something we, correct me if I'm wrong, that's not something we've dealt with, at least in the technology sphere,
right,
before.
It's not just a foreign company. It's that any private company in China is inherently an arm of the Chinese intelligence services, if they wanted to be. There's no such thing as private business in China.
Precisely, yeah. So that's the key. So we've had the presence of foreign companies, obviously, but what tends to change the conversation now, or perhaps what's realigning the conversation right now.
Good. We got our first pun in.
That's right. That's right. Is the fact that China has taken a strategy, and to be honest with you, it's a coherent strategy from their perspective and relatively effective, to fuse their government and private sector industry. They look, China is like every other country in the history of the world. They want to amass and wield influence for their own ends. I don't begrudge them that. That is a coherent way to operate in an international system like ours. Mm-hmm. They have looked at the United States and made the rational assessment that a part of what has allowed us to have the success that we've had is our very strong, vibrant industrial base, particularly our technological industrial base. And they, China, have made the decision, we can't wait for that to develop on our own. Mm-hmm. So what we're going to do is we're going to try and leapfrog a lot of the R&D side of that, which is the slower part of the chain. And we're going to steal a bunch of intellectual property. And they've done that for decades. And they've done it so well that they are now legitimately beginning to innovate.
Mm. How would you compare, so before we move on to sort of the debates on the right in this country, 1980s, you could say a lot of these things about Japan, mm-hmm. right? Japan is a rising industrialized power that in many ways sort of starts with cheap products, steals things arguably, yep. and then starts transitioning into markets that America used to dominate, whether that's automobiles or electronics. How does the, are there any lessons that we should take from how we handled Japan's rise in the 80s that we think about these issues today?
Sure. And so on the one hand, yes, we absolutely need to be looking at history and particularly that history and avoiding any similar mistakes. At the same time, I don't think that we need to be bound because it's not a one-for-one kind of parallel.
Yeah.
So in the sense of lessons learned, look, we don't need to overreact. No one needs to be running for the hills. We don't need to be, paralyzed by what is a very real and difficult problem. Hmm. We're still very dynamic. We're still very agile. We can address this, but it's going to take some serious thinking. Two, one of the big distinctions, though, between the Japanese challenge and the Chinese challenge now is the sheer scale and speed of it. Mm-hmm. Japan was real, and we had very real concerns, and some of our concerns were overblown. But what we were primarily concerned about was its presence in a couple of discrete markets that were important markets, but still fairly narrowly construed. China is across the board.
Mm-hmm. And I think China is targeting really the center of gravity of the American economy and the engine of its economic growth and global dominance.
Well, and precisely. So and what you have when it comes to technology policy in general is this intersection of foreign policy, economic policy, legal policy, social policy, right? None of these things are untouched by technology. In fact, all of them are kind of decisively influenced by technology. And so when we see the rise of a Chinese presence in that, that in and of itself, I'm okay with. You know, for example, on the Japanese thing, we work great with Japan now, mm-hmm. right? So it's not the fundamental issue is not that there's another power that's growing in stature in these industries. We're great with that. The problem is the intention of the government behind that rise and how they are actively using these technologies to challenge and ultimately endanger U.S. interests.
Yeah.
And that goes to your point about the role of Chinese apps in the U.S. market. When you were talking about companies that, as you mentioned, Sugar, they don't have a choice. They don't get to say no to the Chinese government when they say, give us your data. And the Chinese government understands that any data, even Americans' data, that's collected by a Chinese company is Chinese information.
Yeah, exactly.
And so they therefore have access to that data.
So let's go into some of the tech issues.
Yeah.
The three kind of central things up for debate right now on the right, we've talked about it a lot here. Section 230, the Communications and Decency Act, privacy, and antitrust. Tell us a little bit about how you view those particular issues. These are very, very complicated. Mm-hmm. So first, give us what is Section 230? Probably the fourth time we've had it defined here on the show, but I think always worth a reminder. Let's go into that, and then how you view the current debate on the right over it.
Yeah, that's good. Section 230, what people are referencing when they use that terminology is a discrete portion of a broader law called the Communications Decency Act. Section 230 specifically is aimed at it provides a liability protection to internet platforms and companies that specifically says that they cannot be sued or held legally liable for content that users put onto their platforms. Now, the background to it is that the intention of that particular portion of law was to allow and enable private sector companies, technology companies, to decide what they would and would not host on their platforms without fear of being completely sidelined by kind of a shark's teeth of unending lawsuits.
This right. is the start of the internet. This is 1996. Oh, the man, norms yeah. weren't there.
So it's like AOL chat rooms.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, it's essentially right. But the, yeah. but the point is that, you know, look, at that time, I mean, it really was the Wild West in terms of what you would put on a chat right. room and that kind of thing. And, you know, companies were actually, what the government was trying to do with this section was incentivize them to kind of remove the most vile things and then not be sued for impinging on people's freedom of speech and that kind of thing. It is undoubtedly true that subsequently, that protection has been very broadly interpreted by a series of courts and by the companies themselves. And it is now provoking a very serious, I think, worthwhile conversation on the conservative and politically right side of things about the advisability of those protections, particularly in a context where a great many people on the right, especially, feel aggrieved and concerned about how they're treated by these platforms. There's concerns about censorship. There's concerns about political bias. And so Section 230 is one of the tools that people are discussing and often trying to reach for as a means of kind of correcting what they see as imbalances and how online services work. Mm-hmm.
So why don't you go into your view as to why that's an important thing to keep for technology companies, even while thinking in a right-leaning mindset?
Yeah. Well, so the first thing is so I lead all technology policy at the Heritage Foundation. And so that's a broad scope of people. Mm-hmm. And we have people, and we've put out a paper specifically that addresses some of the legal offerings that have been made in this context. Look, I'm empathetic to a lot of the concerns that people raise about tech, about its persona of being this kind of left-leaning liberal institution. I think many of these companies deliberately foster that notion. And I think many of these companies have done a terrible job of meaningfully engaging people with very real legitimate concerns. And, you know, so for example, often the companies will say, look, yes, the mass majority of our people are liberal. We're kind of unapologetic about that, but that doesn't affect our services. And you should just trust that we're not kind of hurting you in the way that we provide services. Well, maybe. But it gets hard when, so for example, a couple of years ago, Tim Cook was in a shareholders meeting and one of his shareholders asked him about limiting some of their environmental work to only things that were, you know, kind of financially viable. And, you know, according to the reports, Tim Cook gets pretty heated and says, look, when we make these decisions, you know, something along the lines of we're not worried about, quote, the ROI or the return on investment. We're trying to make the world a better place. Mm-hmm. Well, okay, you know, if you want conservatives to believe that you're a rational business that is constrained by normal profit motives and that you're not political, well, statements like that from your CEO can justifiably maybe make people wonder.
Yeah.
Right? And then when you know, Google decides to get out of the Project Maven contract with the Department of Defense, or that it's not going to run.
And what was the Project Maven?
Project Maven was a artificial intelligence research program for the Department of Defense that would have had a whole host of applications. Certainly some of them would have been lethal, but others would have been things like, you know, humanitarian assistance and being able to find people who needed help in a earthquake situation or something like that. Well, anyways, so when Google withdrew from Project Maven and when it decided not to compete for the Department of Defense's cloud contract, in both cases it issued public statements that framed their decision in moral and principial terms. They said that, you know, continuing in these programs would violate their principles. And then they constantly frame their conversation, these kind of right side of history arguments. Well, okay, that's their right to do it, but you can't take that course of action and then be surprised when conservatives take you at your word and say, okay, well, then you have an ideological agenda that you're pursuing and you intend to operate your business in accordance with that. So that sets the framework for every conservative then to interpret every perceived slight after that.
And the key thing too is this isn't just sort of a small business, you know, if it's barely making a profit, deciding to ignore return on investment. This is a massive,
they just hit $1 trillion. They literally hit $1 trillion, right? In market.
No, I mean,
cap.
Like these are the biggest companies in the history of the world.
Right. They could afford to do it. They could make probably, this is probably not a single decision Google could make this entire year that would ruin the business.
Yeah.
So I'm gonna make one more point, yes, and then I'm gonna come back around and say, but yeah, right, okay. Mm-hmm. So Google is an example. It's not the only example, but you know, Google says, look, we would never weight our searches. We would never kind of politically alter search results and that kind of thing. Well, you're actively pursuing the opportunity to roll out search in China, which would necessarily require that you not allow results that have anything to do with, you know, human rights or democracy. Like to work there, you have to do that, which shows an openness to do exactly the thing that a lot of people are concerned you're doing. Now they'll say, look, we're just complying with laws in wherever we operate. In the United States, we don't have to do that. In China, we do. Well, I mean, that's an excuse, but there were many people in Nazi Germany who said they were just complying with the law.
It's a moral equivalency of the law.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Exactly. Okay, so that's me kind of poking tech in the chest. At the same time, I have not seen dispositive proof of any type of systemic bias or negative provision of services to conservatives. There are numerous examples that individuals can point to. Oftentimes when you review those, at least half of them can be traced back to an actual violation of something about the terms of service, right? Mm. Not intentional necessarily, but clearly spelled out somewhere that, hey, you can't do this. You know, a significant portion of the other time is that despite all the marketing, the AI algorithms that are being applied on content moderation, they're not as good as we like to think. And so, you know, that political ad that you tweeted, it for some reason to the AI looked a lot like this, you know, cigarette ad that's banned, right? And so the automated process kind of moves it off. And then when you appealed it, they actually looked at it, realized, okay, no, it was fine, and they reinstitute it. Now, again, if you're working from inside the worldview that I was talking about earlier in terms of like an assumption of bias, it's hard to believe those types of explanations because it just doesn't fit, right? But the reality is when you think about the sheer volume of content that is happening every day, I mean, it's hundreds of thousands of photos on Instagram every minute of every day. I think it's, you know, like, 4 billion searches on Google every minute of every day. It's just a scale of a problem that a lot of users may not fully appreciate. Mm. And so when outcomes like these one-offs happen, it can feel like this is systematic. But the reality is conservatives can look online and see that we have a thriving presence online. We do.
Sure.
You know, I mean, we're all over the place. We're all over Facebook. We're all over Twitter. We're all over Instagram. And there's a reason why this administration and previous Republican administrations have spent what they've spent on social media and online advertising.
So I'm hearing empathy for the conservative argument.
Absolutely.
And then framing the debate over regulation as to whether there is not political bias. I do agree with you. There is no dispositive proof of systemic bias. However, why is bias the operating question? Why is bias the operating assumption over whether regulation could occur? Because my pushback would be is that this is about power over civil discourse, about supranational entities that are capable of subverting or operating outside the purview of the nation that gave birth to them through R&D, human capital, and all these other things. And they are not constrained by the government. So So from that perspective, maybe let's talk about Section 230, privacy and antitrust.
Yep, that's great. That's exactly. Yeah. So to answer your specific question, why is bias the word? Well, bias has been the justification levied by the majority of right movement folks in terms of they feel aggrieved. They want their pound of flesh. I'm empathetic to how they've arrived there, right? Mm-hmm. But your point is actually the point that I spend a lot of time making. So I take time and I deconstruct a lot of the worst fears about where tech is, but then I'll quickly pivot and say, but they could do all of that.
Right.
I don't think they are, but they certainly have the capacity that you're describing. And we as a society haven't had that conversation. We're not thinking particularly well about that. And so a large part of what the Heritage Foundation is doing and the program that I'm trying to build there does is, one, build sophisticated consumers of these issues so that we can meaningfully pivot and have that broader, frankly, more important conversation.
Sure.
Go ahead. So here's where the problem starts to come in, though, which is that you're framing this around consumers, yep. right? And this is why the interesting debate on the right now is over the power of government and what role libertarianism and the free market plays in this sort of system. Because the problem is that if you put on your free market hat, okay, so Google, let's say Google was being systemic. Let's say there was a world where, yep. and this is the concern here. The concern is, yes, Google right now is not systemically biased against conservatives, but who knows what a post-2020 where Trump wins re-election world looks like. Mm-hmm. Who knows about a Facebook where Mark Zuckerberg isn't as empowered as he is right. to resist the pressure on political ads. So if you just sort of assume you're living in that world, let's say next year, how much power do consumers actually have over these industries? Because sort of the, you know, to put on a left-wing critique here, the internet is different than sort of like a baker. Right. So the internet is a platform that by necessity sort of lends itself to not monopolies in the legal sense, but sort of, look, there's a reason why there's one main search engine. No one wants to use the fourth or fifth best search engine. I don't want to have five different social media profiles, so I just use Facebook. So it doesn't seem like that's a situation where consumers, without the power of government, have any ability to influence. So what's your response to that? And I said it's a left-wing response, but it's the response that people on the right are also adopting as well, too.
Yeah, so, man, those are all great. I'm going to try and engage them in a kind of systematic way.
We've got time, so that's good.
All right, so one, stipulating for a moment everything you just said, one thing that's unavoidable about this conversation is that so far as we have kind of operated up until this point as a nation, particularly as a free market economy, it is undeniable that these questions are running headlong into very serious questions about freedom of speech issues for these companies and even private property rights, right? So these companies are private companies, and as such, under our constitutional system, enjoy certain freedom of speech rights, which include them being able to decide what content they will and will not host. Lots of people disagree with that, but just from a legal standpoint and a constitutional standpoint, that has certainly been the case. Same thing on the property rights. So the thing that makes Facebook valuable isn't lolcat videos, right? It's their ability to attract and then have deep, deep insights into audiences that they can then allow people to market to. And so the algorithms that they use to do that, well, that's their gravy, right? That's their special sauce. That's proprietary. And code itself has actually been ruled by multiple courts as being speech.
Right.
And so that doesn't lessen any of the very real concerns that you're raised. All I want to do in bringing that up is say, look, we have a real tension between some fundamental American constitutional interests and values.
I think the response there, though, would be, yeah, they can do whatever they want. They can say whatever they want. Why should we give them the greatest legal gift of all time, which is Section 230 of the Communications Decency right. Act, which is why should we not? I mean, because frankly, if we repeal that, it would they would have to spend billions in compliance fees, and they would at least have to behave, quote unquote, like a normal company. What's the response to that?
Well, so what I can do is I can articulate the response. So, look, we at Heritage are taking a pretty deep dive on this because there is kind of the fracturing that you're describing. And to the degree that we can bring some type of coherence to that conversation, we're really going to try, right? But the answer to your question is the intent behind the Section 230 is what its proponents would tell you was actually to expand and maximize freedom of speech, not constrain it. So they would understand Section 230 as being complementary to the constitutional ideal that we're trying to pursue, right? And also to expand an understanding of the free market, that these companies, look, I mean, as you mentioned, they're driving our economy. There's just no way around it. Sure. And these types of lawsuits certainly would have an impact on them. A portion of that impact would almost assuredly have implications for their ability to innovate as resources are kind of moved elsewhere. But then I also, you know, a friendly reminder to conservatives, knowing what we know about these companies and how they interpret speech codes and the like, if we make them liable for content, how likely is it that it's actually going to be our content, content that they think or often call hate speech, is actually what's going to be taken down, right? So I'm not actually sure that the net of an action like some people are pursuing is a net gain for us. It may have some benefits. I mean, I certainly wouldn't deny. And there's a part that says there are people who argue, hey, look, Section 230 is a market intervention itself. Why are we okay with that? You know, if you're kind of anti-market intervention, others would answer that by saying, well, but it's an intervention that expands freedom, doesn't constrain it. But that's a debatable, those are all debatable propositions. My fundamental point up until this moment has been that debate has not been happening with sufficient sophistication or consideration. I want to elevate that debate.
So I think we're kind of dancing around. Tucker Carlson, of course, came at your organization.
He did.
Basically said that you and your organization was promoting the keeping of Section 230 as a result of, I guess, either political donations and just an outdated ideology. You know, giving you the chance now to respond to that.
Well, number one, we've responded to Tucker.
Yeah, I've seen that. Right.
And actually, we've had conversations with Tucker, and sure. I think we're at a good place. Mm-hmm. And look, when the facts are on Tucker's side, he can be a very effective prosecutor, and he's a very compelling voice, and people listen to him for a reason. On this particular case, there was a misunderstanding, and there were kind of two just wrong assertions. The misunderstanding was that the paper that was being referenced was the Heritage position on Section 230. It wasn't. It was the Heritage position on a particular proposal by Senator Josh Hawley on what to do about Section 230. I think he understands that now. I think that's actually been clarified.
Okay.
But in the paper itself, it specifically, in fact, it's the closing paragraph where it says, look, the advisability of Section 230 is something worthy of ongoing political debate, and we're going to do that. It says that explicitly. Now, the two things that were just wrong was an assertion that we were bought and paid for, particularly by the tech lobby, which just isn't true. It's less than 1% of our giving. And I can assure you, no one has bought and paid for me.
Okay.
And I lead tech policy at the Heritage Foundation. Two, you know, Tucker asserted that we had kind of plagiarized or copied word for word something out of the tech industry's talking points. Okay, well, what had actually happened was at the beginning of this paragraph, the author is saying, look, this is a really big issue. In fact, it's so big, some have called it, quote, you know, comma, quote, you know, the most important law. So, yes, we quoted something that is often said by tech policy, you know, lobbyists and such. But we, number one, we quoted it. And then number two, we were using that as an illustration that, look, a lot of people feel very strongly about this. We weren't saying that okay. How they described it was true. But all of that, the fundamental reality is that Tucker and others are making a political argument, one that is an important argument to have, and we're happy for it to be going on. But what Heritage is doing is a policy exercise. And those are related but different, right? So the political exercise is trying to provoke and motivate movement and energy to address an issue. At the Heritage Foundation, I have to take that energy and then translate that into something that's doable and that conforms with law, right? And so it's much more difficult to do that translation process, which is why we are being as deliberate and discreet as we can. That coupled with the reality of what I mentioned earlier in terms of like, there are genuine interests that are in tension as it regards private property and public speech. And we just have to acknowledge, I mean, this is inherently conservative, that any government infringement on freedom of speech, there's reason to believe that that would not be constrained to big tech. That it could be expanded to individuals, could be expanded to the Heritage Foundation or the Hudson Institute, all in the name of fairness. And so we're going to be slow to advocate for those types of changes.
That's great. So we're going to take a quick break, and you'll hear from us soon.
Thank you, Realignment listeners, for joining the podcast. This is John Walters, and I'm Chief Operating Officer at Hudson Institute. I want to thank Marshall and Sagar for this fresh look at some of our most pressing political questions and public policy challenges. The Realignment seeks to unpack the ideas that are reshaping U.S. policy and geopolitical norms using clear-eyed analysis and by challenging conventional wisdom. This approach to policy analysis is also a goal of all of our work at Hudson and is the central focus of another project of ours, the Hudson Institute Political Studies Program. Hudson Political Studies is a six-week summer fellowship for undergraduates that takes place here in Washington, D.C. each summer. The 36 students selected from across the country and around the world spend the summer studying some of the fundamental texts that shape our political ideas and shape the American founding. They also engage in workshops devoted to current policy problems with experienced practitioners, and they hear from distinguished individuals from public life, the thought leaders of today. The program is free of charge, and all students receive a $3,000 stipend. If you are an undergraduate seeking a unique and challenging study of politics and policy, I urge you to apply for the class of 2020 at hudsonpoliticalstudies.org. Now, back to the podcast.
So let's talk about, I think that the more structural question here, though, is how does an organization like Heritage, because I operate in good faith, I assume this is a principled argument on your part. The principles of Heritage, though, are very Reaganite. Very sort of the conception of conservatism that it's advancing is from the 1980s.
No doubt.
Where we were not having debates. We're not bringing up Theodore Roosevelt, as certain people do on the right now, to cite antitrust actions or to talk about why government should intervene. How does Heritage itself navigate a world where the very nature of the right, for a variety of reasons we talk about a lot, are changing, right? So it's much easier to defend or articulate these principles or even interact with other companies, whether that's from a sort of funding perspective or even an engagement perspective, when there's less when there's a ingrained sort of support for or acceptance of business and commerce and sort of these actors. So how do you think the right and your organization should navigate these changing spaces, right? Because the right's less libertarian.
So number one, I'm very proud of how our organization is engaging this. I understand it doesn't please everybody all the time, but one of the reasons why the Heritage Foundation is the Heritage Foundation is because we have elected to orient ourselves off of fundamental principles. Our constitutional government is inherently a constraining, our constitution is a constraining document, right? And our founders made a deliberate choice that our government would rather our government prioritize stability over agility. Right, they did not want our nation to be whipsawed based on the pure passions of any given political moment. Instead, they wanted to establish a system that could withstand the test of time. This is part of the brilliance of the founders. And so I don't deny the rise of many of the currents that you're describing. I'm kind of swimming in those currents on a daily basis. But I think the only safe way to navigate those for the long-term thriving of the nation is to kind of orient off of that kind of first principles horizon. And while it is true that for many in the Republican Party and on the conservative side of the spectrum, to kind of look back that and to look back at those principles and kind of make them synonymous with the Reagan era of government, the reality is that it's actually more appropriate, I think, to say that the Reagan era of government was just self-consciously orienting itself on those principles. So I would say the principles defined Reagan, not Reagan defined the principles.
But isn't there an argument to be said that the issues are what define that orientation rather than the principles? So Reagan, for example, didn't have to adjudicate, or at least his DOJ didn't have to adjudicate whether or not Facebook could buy Instagram and WhatsApp. That's an example of a debate from 2012 to 2013 where, so I completely personally disagree with the idea that you could take away Facebook and, you know, take away Instagram and WhatsApp today. But my problem, though, with a lot of these arguments on your side is if we were to magically go back to 2012 and 2013, there would just be a very uncritical look at those acquisitions. And that's sort of the problem here, right? The sort of the principles-based argument sort of always is going to continue to move goalposts. And I want you to add on that.
Yeah, I think the principles-based argument leads to a path dependency, which leads to conglomeration and consolidation in the tech industry with a supranationalist, like I talked about before, that inherently does not have the national interest at its heart. So I think this is really a conversation about power. And I think, you know, another thing that, you know, conservatism is supposed to look at, and I talked to Senator Josh Hawley about this, is that we should be skeptical of power concentrated in all forms. Mm-hmm. So why is it that it just the government is limited to that when you have an Google, $1 trillion market cap, it just hit it sometime in the last week, or Alphabet, their holding company. Why should we not be skeptical of their role, not just over our daily lives, I mean, from what, the billions of people who use that product?
Yeah, no, these are, look, these are great points and good questions. So on the one, I think it's a mistake to think that that Heritage or anyone else that's articulating something that I'm articulating is not skeptical of these companies. So your point that it is an inherent reality for conservatism to suspect power at any point. And that's because of our principled understanding of the nature of man, whether he's in government or in industry. We understand that the concentration of power can or most often leads to, concerning actions. So, and I think my commentary probably reflects this too, that there's legitimate concern here.
Yeah.
But the reality is that, well, before I move on, two, I'm actually in agreement that many of the legal structures, the kind of antiquated regulatory environment, and even our understanding of kind of modern business in many ways, we're trying to answer what I think are truly novel challenges with old solutions that just don't fit.
Yeah.
Right. So, and this goes to like the antitrust question. Conservatives, I think, have a very good reason to be naturally skeptical of the way antitrust has been pursued previously. Overly broad application, market constraining, just not good. At the same time, I don't know that anybody has a particularly good understanding of kind of tech economics. You know, so when we see individual companies who are amassing massive troves of data. Now, that data is being willfully given by consumers.
Mm-hmm. It's not stolen. But
it's not
there.
Stolen, but they got it, right? And we can't really articulate in meaningful, concrete terms how the continual accumulation of broader and broader volumes of data could enable a type of competitive edge that we as consumers may ultimately not be comfortable with.
And I just thought of something. I just sort of dismissed the idea that data is stolen, but you do see weird spaces where, did you read that New York Times story a week or two ago about that company?
The face
recognition company, right? So it's a company, people put the social media out there, but it's aggregating it and they're using these algorithms in ways we don't quite understand. I think that's the thing that's so difficult for me because, and this is why I think we've tried to bracket this conversation to technology, right? I think that, you know, the idea of applying the free market principles to other areas. So for example, we're not talking about retail or fast food restaurants. There's a reason we're talking about tech, because there's an area where just the software 10x multiplier is such that there's just so much power here. And that's why
let me build on that, which is that I consented to put my photo on LinkedIn. Yep. You know what I didn't consent to? Somebody mining my LinkedIn photo in order to use and recognize my face and turn that over to the Boston Police Department.
Well, so you kind of did. Now, you may not have been aware of it, but you kind of did. And this goes to the point, right? Yeah. So the ability to do the fact that Instagram was
legally, you're probably right.
Well, that's the key, right? So, and this goes to my underlying point about sophistication. Like, look, consumers need to understand, it's trite now, but the consumers need to understand, you are not the customer, you're the product. Mm. Right? So all of this is laid out in legalese detail in these terms of service. I understand why you don't read all of them, but the reality is Instagram said, hey, we're going to do this, right? This is how we make money. You're not paying anything for the service. This is how we make money. Now, what I would prefer, and everything that I've been articulating in terms of free market presumes to work correctly an informed consumer base, right? And they're not, right? So our consumers have been adopting technology far more quickly than they have understood it. And that is, again, one of the things that we at Heritage are really trying to focus on. So we're looking at what tools can we build and kick out there that will help at least people who you know turn to Heritage, their awareness of what's going on, how this data is used, what network effects and social media means.
But why is that on Heritage? Why is that not? Why is it not a responsibility onto the company itself to say, when people look, it's like vitamins, right? Like you don't just that people can't just sell you vitamins. They have to say, here's what's in my vitamins. Here is the possible side effects of my vitamins. Here is everything in my product. Like why is it? Why can it not be upon the government or you know any consumer advocate to say that whenever I use LinkedIn or whatever, I should be like, yeah, this stuff might get mined and used to one day, maybe used one day in a law enforcement investigation or the passive, you know, recording of my face and checking that against large databases during a law enforement operation.
You mean more, and basically you mean in a more comprehensible fashion
than a 50-page. Than a fake terms of service agreement, right?
Well, I mean, I don't know if they're fake as much as they're...
I'm not saying they're not legally binding, but like nobody...
They're certainly opaque.
Like, I mean, South Park was making fun of this, what, a decade ago about iTunes. Now it's probably even worse than it is now.
So, okay, so there's a couple of issues that kind of blended there. So let's take the kind of law enforcement side of that. So in terms of law enforcement use... Typically, what's being applied by law enforcement use is honestly kind of public square arguments. Hey, you're walking down the street. You have no expectation of privacy. If the fact that we had a traffic camera that picked you up and we get to use that, you know, sorry. Now, different consumers can find that compelling or not compelling as an answer, but that's kind of where they're coming from. So I'm going to just move that part of the conversation off. It's worth having, but different. In terms of how these companies are using the information, we've already kind of belabored the point that, look, they've got terms of service. They're at least legally covered typically. And when they're not, and when people become aware of that, well, that's when you have kind of the Cambridge Analytica argument. And, and so that's the market responding. To your point about, well, why is that Heritage's, you know, responsibility? Well, the going in position for conservatives historically, at least, and certainly at the Heritage Foundation, is like, if there is a non-government solution, that's often preferable to a government solution. And as a civil society institution that has, you know, some heft and some influence, we're very happy to kind of throw that heft and influence around in an effort to help consumers, to help policymakers, and help the government itself better understand a situation and perhaps find solutions that don't require, you know, the at best clumsy hand of government. That is not to say, though, to be very clear, that this Venn diagram between kind of government and private is always crystal clear, because a lot of, and this is my background, a lot of these same questions aren't constrained only to consumer good. They start getting into national security implications when you start thinking about foreign influence operations on an internet platform, when you start thinking about the harvesting of American user data information by foreign companies and the like. So I'm better right now at diagnosing problems than I am kind of giving prescriptions. Because I've only been at this at Heritage for 2 years, and I just haven't figured out the internet yet.
That's also, and to be fair to you, that's also the nature of the moment we're in.
That's right.
I mean, that's sort of, that's part of it. And we're not, and I just want to say, like, we're not bringing you on here to say, like, where are the solutions?
No, hey, listen. It's, I'm not in any way, shape, or form offended or challenged by this. Like, these are the questions, right? And none of it is easy. All of it is hard. And complexity should not paralyze us and you know, kind of an unthinking grip on some idealistic notion of history also shouldn't prevent us from taking decisive action when it's warranted. I wouldn't advocate any of that.
Sure.
Before we move on from this section, Sagar, I think you had a question about Google and conservatives. And
I
how
think
that
one of the core arguments that Tucker levied was that one of the most common retorts is, if you don't like Google, if you don't like Facebook, build your own Google or build on Facebook. Yeah. I think that's ridiculous. I mean, on its face, just in terms of the sheer market realities. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah.
It's tough, right? Because the normal way that it can, the normal, if there was a bakery that was ill serving you, it would actually be pretty straightforward to do
Google's
that.
Not a bakery.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So this goes to my point that I was making earlier about, we don't really have a sufficiently good understanding of the value of network effects. So someone can rightly answer that argument by saying there is no Google alternative, right? Like, there is no one who can meet my requirements this way. Now, that's a fair thing, but often what I will then respond to my, you know, friends with is like, well, okay, when you look something up, what do you use? Google. Okay. Even the ones who complain about Google's bias against conservatives, they almost always say, well, Google. Mm. Well, why? Well, because they're results are the best.
Yeah.
Rarely do you have to go beyond the second return to get exactly what you're looking for. And let's remember what we're asking Google to do. Google, we want you to scour the internet and based on average, 6-word string, give me exactly what I'm looking for. And 99.2% of the time, they nail it.
See, this is I don't want to belabor this point too much, but I think my inner Yelp advocate is coming out here because I'm sure you know
that's
this
good,
argument.
That's good.
Yelp would say to that, yes, Google has the best search results because they steal our content, right, or they design their structure in a way that they no longer allow us to post our reviews the way we post it. Wikipedia would say that they have structured that basically Google has a system where you could basically see the preview of a Wikipedia article, and there is a direct correlation between them introducing that tool and actual engagement on Wikipedia
and
going down.
Right.
And what Wikipedia would also add is that their entire system and business model was based on people going to their site. They then see the donation page. Yeah. They then like become contributors and they want to have 1% of their contributors, this and that. Yes, they're number one, but the question is how did they become number one?
Well, okay. So,
and I will stipulate that obviously that it's an amazing product, but there are these weird intersections.
No, it's great. It's great. So to answer your question directly, how did they become number one? They came up with a proprietary algorithm that the majority of the market prefers. Overwhelming majority, 98% of the market wants. Now, some people will call that a market failure. Others will look at that and say, well, that's a market choice. That's a decision made, right? And then you want to ask Wikipedia, how much internet traffic do you think you'd be getting without Google?
That's the fair,
right?
No, I think that's a fair response.
So the question
you can't
is like
your own Google.
You know, like, you know, even conservatives. So the two points I'm trying to make are, one, even conservatives who are convinced in their own mind that Google is biased against them still turn to Google because it consistently gives them what they want. And anyone who was convinced that they were being systematically oppressed and manipulated, that wouldn't make sense to continue to kind of return to them, right? That kind of battered wife syndrome. Why would you allow that to persist if you genuinely thought that? Two, we also have to understand that a lot of these services, the ones that people are most concerned about, in one sense, are inherently biased, and that's what we're asking them to do. So, for example, we look at Facebook and we say, Facebook, I want you to look at all of my friends and connections, and I want you to surface content that I care about. I don't really want to see Crazy Uncle Joe going off on, you know, Donald Trump or Joe Biden. What I really want is my sister in New Haven, you know, and the kids and the pictures of my niece, right? And I want you, without me having to tell you all the time, to surface content I care about. And Facebook says, hey, you know what? We can do that, right? And so what we're asking them to do is to curate, therefore make a biased decision on the content that I want to get and not get. And they do that. The same thing with search, the same thing with your Twitter feed, and so on. And when we're talking about the billions of uploads on all these platforms, that is a Herculean task. And they do it pretty doggone well, so much so that they're attracting the communities and the user bases that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. That in no way, shape, or form absolves them from criticism, when they either refuse to or cannot adequately explain themselves, when there are enough examples of choices that they've made that just don't make sense. Like, why in the world would you identify the trailer for a pro-life movie as propaganda? Why would you do that? Now, they'll have an answer for that. And oftentimes, it's acceptable enough to at least where you can't dismiss it. But when you factored into that point that I made earlier in the conversation in terms of the way they portray themselves publicly as these kind of liberal bastions, these kind of ideologues, well, then you can't possibly be surprised when your consumer base looks at you, takes you at your word and says, you're doing this because you think this about politics.
We're going to introduce a segment here. So you had a cool piece at the Daily Signal where you had five predictions for 2020. So I wanted you to, in a relatively rapid fire way, I'm going to list them out and just explain what they mean. So, you know, so A, cyber conflicts become real conflicts.
Yeah. So the reality is the cyber domain's getting pretty active, and there's a lot of actors in there, a lot of nation states, a lot of hacking syndicates, a lot of individuals. One of the unique aspects of the domain is that one individual can have outsized impact. And because the kind of norms of conflict in that domain haven't really been set, the likelihood of them spilling over into real world effects are increasing. Mm-hmm. So, for example, you know, had Iran responded to the killing of Soleimani by undertaking some type of cyber attack here in the United States, and let's say that cyber attack had massive economic impact or, God forbid, had killed somebody, well, there's very real possibility that the United States would have put a Tomahawk missile on somebody for
it, right?
So that type of activity is becoming more and more likely.
Next, a large-scale cyber attack.
Yeah, well, you know, look, in 2017 and 2018, we saw some massive attacks largely emanating out of Russia with the NotPetya attack, for example, went across the globe, billions of dollars worth of damage. We've seen activities coming out of Iran against Saudi energy companies that are pretty big. Look, these things, number one, just the scale of the operations themselves seem to be growing because people are getting more comfortable, or at least more ambitious. But then also the unintended consequences of these things are still a very real concern.
More Chinese abuses.
This I agree with.
No one saw that coming, Sagar.
So Australia has really been on the kind of leading edge of this where they have... More Chinese abuses. Yeah. More awareness of Chinese abuses. Yes. Okay, good.
Bad transcription. It's on me.
Okay, so Chinese abuses. Yeah, look, the Chinese government is like straight up doing Nazi stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's just no way around it. There's no denying it. They are imprisoning between 1 and 2 million religious and political minorities in Xinjiang province. They are pioneering a new governance model of what I call technologically enabled authoritarianism. Mm-hmm. And I think that that technological enabled authoritarianism will be the chief export along China's Belt and Road Initiative if it is allowed to mature. I think we're going to become more aware of that. I think with the New York Times reporting of the China papers and all that stuff, I think that just keeps coming. And I think that's going to be a defining context for U.S. political posture toward them.
Here's your chance to talk about Australia and China.
So when we think about political influence, Americans often think about Russia and the United States in 2016. Well, what our ally, the Australian government, has really begun to unearth is massive Chinese political influence within their country, paying off politicians. Like, a number of politicians have been straight up found to be in the pocket of China. The Chinese, because they're close trading partners with Australia, are using every economic lever they can to affect political outcomes that they prefer. I think Australians are getting fed up with that. I think they're becoming more aware of that. And I suspect that they're going to, that's going to continue. And then they're going to be reaching out and trying to build some type of a Western Democratic coalition to confront it.
Yeah. Last and most depressing European capitulation on China.
Yeah. It already happened this week, huh?
Yeah. So I spent time in December, myself and a couple of colleagues went to Italy specifically to talk to them about how they were thinking about Huawei and 5G. And one of the things I came away with was a lot of these governments are really struggling for legitimacy. Decades of failing to deliver on promised cradle-to-grave entitlements has led to massive swings in political stability in their relative systems of government. So every politician is trying their best to provide whatever services they can. That certainly will extend to things like 5G and other technological advancements. The only problem is that Europe doesn't have a sufficiently strong or robust tech sector.
Right.
And so they're highly dependent on the United States and China. Well, because China is willing to subsidize their companies, companies like Huawei can deliver 5G for a third of the cost. That's very attractive for someone who's thinking near term and trying to deliver on political promises, but it's catastrophic for people who are thinking about the long-term security of their countries. Hmm. Unfortunately, that type of short-termism increasingly defines much of Europe.
So Sagar, how about you take
this last section? Final section here. So what is an issue or topic that you've recently reconsidered your opinion on, I guess, in the tech sector?
or anything. What's not even limited to tech? Like, what's something that?
Don't interpret my kind of slowness as like I haven't changed my mind on anything. I typically walk into a lot of conversations like, I don't know. So there's a number of conversations where I remain unresolved. Mm. So for example, the advisability of Section 230 is currently construed. Mm. I genuinely feel the desire to maintain something that has helped facilitate the economic strength of the United States that these companies have done. I also understand that there's a broader context that there is no scenario where the United States secures itself absent a deep partnership with the private sector, including these technology companies. Mm. And so far beyond just not wanting to kill the golden goose, I also don't want to hobble companies who I think are going to provide the decisive edge in future geopolitical realities.
That's great. So thank you so much for coming. It's been really great.
It's my pleasure, guys.
Thanks.
Yep.
Cut.
Great. Seriously, that was great.
That was great.
I hope you enjoyed the episode. As I talked about last week, if you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, you can email me at mkosloff@hudson.org. That's mkosloff@hudson.org. And as always, you can subscribe to the show, and please throw us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to your podcasts. We'll see you next week.